Welcome to Speaking Out for the Blind. I'm Brian McKellen. Have you ever wanted to draw or paint? Have you ever wanted to share your own works of art with family or friends or the general public? Have you ever wanted to become the next Pablo Picasso or Vincent van Gogh? Today's show may inspire you to pursue your dream art career. Blind artist John Bramblett joins the show today to tell our audience about his unique painting processes. John will also share how he painted his individual works and portraits of famous celebrities and how he has been recognized at an art gallery in Texas, as well as his workshops and TV appearances. John will also talk about his book titled Shouting in the Dark, My Journey Back to the Light. In the book, John tells his life story and how he grew to be the blind painter. Hello, John.
Well, hello, Brian. I'm so happy to be here today.
Me too. How are you doing?
Well, great. I'm having a great day. How about you?
Me too. Very cloudy here in Livermore, California, but I'm having a good day. So, John, let's first talk about your vision. I learned from an Amazon.com synopsis of your book that you became legally blind more than 10 years ago due to complications with the chronic brain disorder called epilepsy. Can you tell our audience more about epilepsy and its symptoms and how the disease contributed to your vision loss?
Oh, sure. I think one of the things people notice most about the epilepsy, of course, are the seizures. And there's lots of different kinds of seizures. The kinds that people think about most of the time, I think, are the grand mal or the tonic-clonic. But there's also other seizures where they're very small. You might not even notice a person is having them, but they can affect the person's the way a person remembers all sorts of things. And it's no fun. I don't recommend that epilepsy at all. But the type that caused the vision loss in me, it was they finally figured out it's a cascading temporal lobe seizure, and they weren't able to figure out exactly what was happening until after I had lost my vision. So they were able to go back and kind of trace the damage and then figure out what had happened. But during it, there wasn't much help. But one of my doctors said it was basically like getting a concussion just over and over and over again. But it was just a type of seizure I was having, and which is a very rare sort of thing. So I don't want to worry or concern anybody that has epilepsy, because it's very rare that epilepsy causes vision loss. And when it does, most of the people will have the vision loss come back. But it was the circumstances I was under, and it was a type of epilepsy that I have. This is a very severe type. So that's basically what caused that.
And one of the big things that I hear that can cause epilepsy is video games with, or TV shows with flashing lights, reoccurring flashing lights. Did you ever feel those sensations when watching them?
I did a little bit. Flashing lights had a small effect on me. There's some people, if there's a strobe light that goes off or Halloween, you know, comes by and there's all this stuff going on, sometimes that'll trigger their seizures. But and that's one thing about epilepsy, is that there's so many different forms and there's so many different triggers. There's some people who lights don't affect them at all, but if they have an allergic reaction to something, that can throw them into a seizure, or it's just a disease that has so many different forms.
Okay, so I also understand that after having these epileptic seizures, you went into this totally deep depression. You had felt alienated, angry, and even alone. But you overcame this sheltered life when you discovered the vibrant world of painting. Just how did discovering painting help you escape from that lifestyle?
Oh, Brian, that's an excellent question, and I've had epilepsy since I was 2 years old, and I've had other health problems. Like I've had a kidney out by the time I was seven, I've had all kinds of health issues going when I was growing up. And the one thing that I always had to fall back on, though, was art. And I didn't paint at the time, but I drew. And I loved to write, and I loved to draw. And I had a very happy childhood because I had a wonderful family and friends. So I don't look back on my childhood and say, oh, I was sick all the time. It was terrible. I feel like I had a great childhood because of the relationships I had. But whenever I was in the hospital and things weren't good, I always had art to be able to let off the steam. And so art for me has always been incredibly important. It's just been something I've done every day since I can remember. When I was really little, I would wiggle a stick in the mud. You know, I would draw out there. I'd get crayons and paper, and it just kept increasing. You know, as I grew older, took classes on drawing, did drafting, and then it just kept on going. But I never painted though until I actually lost my eyesight. But it was a way for me to be able to cope and to be able to deal with things.
So everybody in our audience here wants to know exactly how you learned to paint those breathtaking pictures, just as a blind person. First, was there a family member, friend, or instructor out there that taught you how to paint, or did you just learn to be an artist all by yourself?
I pretty much learned all by myself when it came to painting with the drawing. I took lessons in that. I took drafting, illustration, and all of that, so that whenever I lost my eyesight, I had this background on illustration and drawing. I had never painted before, though. But I had this background on basic, you know, art skills, obviously, you know, but just not painting. So, and there was, you know, there aren't really instructors or teachers or painting systems out there for people who are blind. You know, there's no book on the visual arts for visually impaired people, unfortunately, but there will be very soon. And so it was mostly me, and it was a big thing to the technology that we have now, because I was able to deal with the computers and the Jaws and Kurzweil, because it opened up the entire world of art for me. So I didn't have to rely on books that were just braille. You know, someone else thought, hey, this is a book that someone wants to read. I was able to go into a bookstore and get all the books on art, anything that I wanted to read. A magazine article that was written 40 years ago, I could scan it to my computer and learn it. So it opened up the world of painting to me, you know. And then building on the background of art that I'd had before from drawing and illustration, it was just, you know, just having to learn how to work with a paint.
So I heard that you had to take 16 hours each day to paint. And how are you able to stick to this time commitment and just have time at the same time for family, friends, and school?
That's a good question. Especially when I first started painting, I would paint 16 hours a day or more, and I didn't sleep a lot, so that helped. I was just too excited to paint, so I would do a lot of painting, and then I would hang out with friends, which was very important to me, because one thing I had learned fairly early on, because of the epilepsy and depression that can come along with that, is that it's good to be around people. Even if you don't feel like you want to be around people, it's good to make sure that you keep that contact. So I always made an effort to go and over to a friend's house or have a friend come over, or I was in a great place where I could walk anywhere, so just be around people. So I always just made that extra effort. And today I paint. It just depends. There's some days I can paint 16 hours. There's some days it's 8. There's some days it's more than 16 hours. And part of it depends on if I'm traveling or the work that I'm doing. But whether I'm traveling or not, I always bring an easel with me. I've always got my art stuff with me, so that if I'm on the road or even if I'm camping, if I'm anywhere, I've always got something where I can paint.
So how does a blind man like you visualize his majestic work and paint that work?
Well, thank you for calling majestic. I appreciate that. and really, it's the same as anyone else, because all art, it's visualized in the mind, whether you're sighted or not. And of course, because I'm not sighted, I use other techniques to be able to get the information. But the actual visualization it takes place in the mind, and I think calling art visual art is a bit of a misnomer. Vision really doesn't have that much to do with it, I don't think. You know, if vision was that important to art, it would be very easy to be able to decide who the best paintings were, the best painters, because you could just give them an eye test. You know, all the painters in that 20/20 vision would obviously produce the best art. And if their vision was a little off that, then their art can't be as good. So, yeah, we don't do that. That's silly. And that's because art is about expression. It's about ideas. And that's the part that really matters.
So you mentioned on your website, that's bramblet.net. We're going to get more into that later, that you follow four unique painting processes or methods to create each of your vivid artworks. One of the first processes out there is the original method. Tell our audience how you follow the original method of painting.
Well, the original method for me is when I first started painting, I began in oil. And the reason I chose oil was because it's a very thick sort of paint. And I knew that I was going to have to find replacements for my eyes, and it would have to be my sense of touch. So everything that a sighted artist does with their eyes, I just have to find a way of doing that with my hands instead. And in reality, that sounds hard to do, but in reality, when it comes to painting, a person's eyes don't really do that much. They tell a person where on the canvas they are. They tell a person where they've been, and that's pretty much it. You know, they also help control color. But if you can figure out a way to know where on the canvas you are and where you've been without using your eyes, then you've pretty much taken the eyesight out of the equation. And in order to do that, I had to develop a way of drawing that I could feel, you know, leaving a raised line, sort of tactile line that I could make, and then go back and feel that line. And that's one thing that took the longest time, I think, was to find a paint that would work, that would dry fast enough, and remain there. So it took a while to find that, and that's the main part of the original method, was learning how to make these raised line drawings that I use in my painting. And all of that stems back from my, all my work as an illustrator and all the drawing that I did from the time that I was a child. So it's recreating a contour sort of drawing, but using raised lines instead of a pencil or graphite or charcoal.
Okay. So you have another method out there. It's called the invisible method. How's this process invisible compared to the original method?
That's a good question. In all of my paintings, for probably the first 6-7 years, there was always these raised lines in my painting from the original drawing. So you would look at the painting, and it would look like anybody else's painting, if they were sighted or not. Except there were these raised lines in it that were from the drawing that helped guide me through the painting process that I would draw down. But there's some techniques with oil painting and glazing and washes, and also if you get into watercolors, which is a very liquid and flowing sort of paint, it can be, or it can be very dry as well. But having raised lines, it hurts things. Like it's hard to do a wash if you're having a flood of color go across the canvas. A raised line acts like a dam, and it blocks all the colors, so you can't have the lines there. So I needed to come up with a method that I could have the line there when I needed it, when I needed to be able to use it as a guide to paint, but then also to be able to take the lines away when I didn't need them anymore. So I developed some methods of having some overlays of lines on a piece of paper that would lay over the canvas, and then I could whip it up when I didn't need it, and then I could lay them back down again. Some techniques of having an underlay, of having lines that were underneath the canvas that you can push through the fabric and you can feel the lines beneath it, but it doesn't interfere with the paint. You know, the paint goes right over them. And I've also been working, I mix my own paints, I grind my own pigments quite a bit, and I've been working on paints that will actually allow me to make a raised line, and then over the period of a day or so, it'll fade into the canvas. So the line is still there, but you can't fill it anymore. So it allows me to be able to draw and use the raised line when I need it, but then when I'm going to do the next step of the painting, the line's not there, and it's not going to block the glazing or the washing. So I don't know if that makes sense. I, um, I spent so much time in the studio that sometimes I go to explain the stuff that I'm doing, and I don't know if I'm explaining it very well or not.
You explain it very well to our audience, Mr. Bramblett. You do. You did a great job. So, explain to our audience the third process of creating your work. Okay, this one is a little more complicated. It's got two distinct parts. Well, let me tell our audience first that this whole method overall is called the color mixing method. And it's got two distinct parts. The textural viscosity method and the proportional method. So why don't you tell me how these processes all work hand in hand, what they entail, and how they differ from the other two processes, original and invisible, that you already discussed.
Oh, sure. And, with the original and the invisible, that has more to do with the drawing, really, and the color mixing, it has to deal with the paint, because that's dealing with color is the third thing that the eyes do for a sighted artist. So if you're non-sighted, you have to come up with a way of being able to mix the colors in a reliable way, a very precise way, without using eyesight. So the first way that I came up with doing this was using oil paints. And oil paints, the great thing about them is that they're made from different substances. So every color is actually made from something different, which gives the paint a different feel, and it's a very slightly different feel. But like burnt sienna feels more like jelly, just a little bit. Whereas titanium white is very thick, like toothpaste. Ivory black is more runny, like oil. And with oil paints, there are mediums that you can mix in with the paint that can further enhance these differences. So with the textural method, you're basically changing the way each color feels. So that when you feel a color, you know, oh, that's black. Oh, this one's white. It's obviously, you know, this is really thick. But what this allows you to do as well is to mix the paint so that you get your colors where one is very thick, one is very thin. And if you want to, say if it's a white and a black and you want to mix a gray halfway between, then you mix the colors so that the texture of the paint is exactly halfway between the feeling of the white and the feeling of the black. And that's actually a very precise way of mixing color. You can mix the exact same color over and over and over again. Actually a little bit more consistently than many-sided painters. So it's right up there. And it's very, very precise. And it's a great way to be able to control your color. With the proportional method, I use that more for paints like acrylics, watercolors, paints that are all made out of the same thing. Like with acrylic paints, it's sort of a plastic polymery sort of paint. It's an artificial sort of thing. So the white feels exactly like the blue, and that feels exactly like the yellow. So there are things that you can add to acrylic paints to change the texture, and sometimes I do that, but a lot of times I'll use the proportional method, which is more like a recipe, like if you're baking a cake. I know that so much of this one color mixed with so much of this other color is going to produce a third color, and so it's just like ingredients in a cake. Or if it's a liquid watercolor, I know if I mix 8 drops of this with 4 drops of that, then I'm going to end up with this other color. So it's a very precise way of mixing colors, but the textural, I think, is more fun. I like that. I like to get my hands in the paint. But if you're dealing with a liquid watercolor or some other paints where you can't do that, then that's a very precise way of doing it without using vision. So combining that with the raised line drawings, you've got a full system of painting. It takes practice, but it turns out to be a very precise, a way of controlling color and a way of being able to establish detail that rivals any sighted painter.
Wow. So in this painting, so in this method of painting, you really must get your feet wet, correct?
Yes. And the more you paint, the better it is. And the techniques that I use, basically, to get around a canvas, when I make those raised lines, is the same sort of techniques that you learn whenever you use a white cane. You know, it's orientation and mobility sort of training. So I, you know, so if any of the listeners who've ever had the O&M, all of the spatial reasoning, the spatial awareness, the making the mental math, or what I use whenever I make a drawing on a canvas. And that's a question I'm asked a lot is how do you do that? And I just, it's the exact same way as a sighted artist would, but I'm using these O&M sort of techniques so that I'll make a raised line on the canvas. I can feel that, and then I can start building from that. But it's actually easier to draw on the canvas than it is maybe to even get around a room. You know, like if you're in a restaurant, even if you've been in that restaurant 100 times, people will move chairs, they'll get up out of their seats, they'll walk around. Things change. But on a canvas, there's nothing there that you didn't put there. So nothing is ever going to change. Everything is always right where I put it. And the more that you work on a painting, every brush stroke, every bit of texture, every bit of detail, every moment you spend on that canvas, you're adding more information to it. And it's easier and easier to get around it, to navigate around the painting. So it's something that just, it starts off as a blank canvas, but as you're working on it, it just becomes more and more easy to navigate all around the canvas.
So
I hope that makes sense.
Yes, it does. So tell me about your final method, resin, really quickly.
Oh, sure. Resin, it's a combination of all of those. Resin painting is a method that dates back thousands of years, and I wanted to get into it because it's such a durable way of painting. And it's a very plasticky sort of, if you think about amber, that's basically hardened resin. And there's resin paintings they found in Cambodia for 2,000 or 3,000 years ago, and they look like they were just painted. And that's basically why I wanted to get into resin. And it allows for extremely bright colors. And that's one thing that's important to me because colors for me, even though I can't see colors with my eyes, they probably mean more to me now than they did when I was sighted because they represent emotion and feeling. So I want colors as bright as I can get them. And resin is a great way of doing that, of just getting colors that are electric, that are just really pop off the canvas.
So let's now talk about some of your brand new works that I found on your website just recently. First tell me really quickly about your painting. So when I ask you about your paintings, I'm going to ask about each of them. You just describe briefly what they look like, and then just tell our listeners about your inspiration for creating the vibrant works. First, tell me about your painting called Something's Wrong with This Picture.
Okay, so Something's Wrong with This Picture. It has a lady on the left-hand side of the painting, and she's holding a cigar. And on the right-hand side of the painting, there are these painted squares, and it's a music painting. Whenever I hear music, I see color. So I do a lot of paintings of musicians, of bands, of live music, and I paint the colors that I hear I get sound color and seeing all mixed up because I see the color when I hear the music. But all of the colors on the right hand side of the painting come directly from the music, and the song is Something Is Wrong with This Picture, and it's from a band called Galactic from New Orleans. And I just love New Orleans. The whole genre, I just love that. And the town I live in, we have a lot of jazz music. We're about 6 hours from New Orleans, and it's just, I just love that. So that's what's in that painting. And a lot of my paintings deal with music.
How about Coca-Cola?
Oh, that's a flavor painting. Whenever I taste flavors, I see color as well. I always have ever since I was little, and it isn't as strong as music. With the music, I see colors very brightly. With flavors, it's a little more of a muted sort of experience, but I try to capture the way that the flavors make you feel. So with this painting, it's actually a painting on glass, and it has the logo of the Coca-Cola bottle, and it's blown up, so you can only see part of the bottle. And behind it, though, are these colors that are swirling in amongst each other. To me, sugar is yellow. It's very sweet, so there's yellow, there's blue from the caramel sort of flavoring. So it's just a riot of color, and But the late over that is part of the logo for the Coca-Cola.
How about New York State of Mind based on Billy Joel's hit single?
Oh, my goodness, yes. I love that painting. And it's a little bit different for a music painting. Some of the music paintings will go note for note. But on this one, though, it's more it's actually one spot in the song where there's a sax solo. So the music is it's echoing all around, and then suddenly this sax player comes in. And in the painting, the center of the painting is dominated by a man playing a sax, and there's a swirl of color all around them. And it's a very dark painting around the edges. There's a lot of dark colors, but then also a lot of bright colors that are mixed in and flowing into that. And it's a resin painting, which allows you to make the colors almost flow into each other like water. So it's more of a ripple sort of effect and a swirly effect. And I just love that part of the song where you've got this crescendo of music and then things kind of get quiet and the sax player comes in and just takes it to a whole other level.
Awesome. Now, real quickly, too, I'm going to just ask you briefly about your various appearances. You've painted portraits of famous skateboarder Tony Hawk and famous blues singer Pops Carter. And you also have made various television appearances on shows such as Texas Country Reporter and the Discovery Channel's Daily Planet. Tell us briefly about all of these appearances, just briefly.
Oh, I started doing a lot of work with nonprofits and charities when I first started to paint, really. And when I first started the show, that led to some media attention, and then that led to working with more nonprofits and more just charities, and it's just gone on and on. It seems like one has fed off the other in a way, but it's been great because we've been able to draw a lot of attention to some different groups. And if there's any time that I get an opportunity to go somewhere and talk or do a benefit or do any sort of work, then I would just jump right on it. And which for me is a little ironic because I've never been one to get on a stage or get in front of a group of people and talk, but I've just seen how much art helps people and how much it's a dramatic thing. It's incredible. And being able to travel and do this has been such a blessing because I've met some of the most wonderful people. It's just been an amazing experience. And when I first lost my eyesight, I really thought my life was pretty much over. I thought that was the end of everything. But through the artwork and painting and the people that I've met, it's just the world's more of a colorful place now than it ever has been.
That's great. So tell me quickly now, where can people get your book, Shouting in the Dark, My Journey Back to the Light, access your work, and just what advice do you have for your audience?
Oh, well, the book should be at any bookstore. If they don't have it, they'll order it for you. Also, Amazon.com is a great place, and they probably have the best deal. I don't know. It always changes, but I always go to Amazon and check just to make sure. But and for my artwork is bramlett.net. So please go there and check it out. And if you have a question about anything, please send me an email. I love emails. I love to talk to people. And the same on Facebook. I'm on Facebook. So, so friend me and we'll chat. and my best, my biggest advice to people is to just don't give up. And if you're into art, if you want to give it a try, if you want some pointers, if there's any way I can help you, just drop me a note because I'd love to help.
Don't give up. That's one of the best pieces of advice I've heard on this show. So, John, you are definitely the inspiration to those blind out there that may just want to pick up a brush and create and just promote their own artistic craft. Thanks for joining us today.
Oh, Brian, it's been totally my pleasure. It's been an honor, and thank you very much, and I hope you have a great rest of the day.
You too. That's all for this edition of Speaking Out for the Blind. Thanks for listening. And remember, to speak out.
You're listening to American Council for the Blind Radio.
By the blind, for the world.